This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Jerome Groopman treats people who have cancer, blood diseases, and AIDS. In fact, he worked on the first AIDS cases diagnosed in 1981. In his new book, The Measure of Our Days, New Beginnings at Life's End, he profiles some of his patients and shares what they have taught him about courage and endurance. Dr. Groopman is a professor of immunology at Harvard Medical School and chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He also conducts lab research into cancer and AIDS. Dr. Groopman's book begins with a story of Kirk, who had advanced kidney cancer when he asked Groopman to treat him, so advanced that Groopman was reluctant to take him on until Kirk finally convinced him.
It wasn't so much what he told me, it was more what I perceived in him. And that was that despite having widespread kidney cancer, and despite having been turned down at many excellent cancer centers for treatment, and despite not fitting into a formal experimental protocol, I felt within him this determination to live, this force and will, and believed that in some way I was obligated, having been touched by that, to respond to him and to treat him, even though I held little hope that we would succeed.
You quote him as saying things like, "I don't take no for an answer. I'm 54. I'm not ready to pack it up and die. I'm a fighter. I don't buy that nothing can be done. Make me a guinea pig. I take risks all the time. That's my business." What's your reaction when you see somebody who has the sense that, like, I'm a fighter and I'm going to lick this thing?
Well, I think it's a very important stance to take in battling disease, understanding that there are no guarantees and that you well may lose. I think the will to fight, the determination is very important. On the other hand, I don't want to be seduced into doing things which have no real rationale or may in the end actually hurt someone and make his or her situation worse than it already is.
Such as?
Well, I think there are people who cancer specialists can treat when there really is so little hope or reason, and administer very toxic drugs, which will make the last days of their lives marked by terrible side effects and perhaps even accelerate their death. So it's a very complicated decision and a very fine balance between wanting to respond and wanting to fight and wanting to save lives, and at the same time, neither indulging yourself, thinking that you'll be the dramatic cowboy, as I put it in that story, who sort of rides into town with his guns blazing but really has no chance to hit a target, or to do something which is really possibly against the best interests of the person in front of you.
Does that sense of, like, I'm a fighter and I'm going to lick this thing, ever cross over into self-delusion?
Well, I think it does. I think that I try to nurture that will and nurture that spirit and feed the energy that the patient is focusing on fighting his disease. On the other hand, you have to be honest and you have to lay out the risks and the real chances that despite the best fight that we can muster, we may not succeed, at least not succeed in a physical context, not succeed in defeating the disease.
The person who we're talking about, who you call Kirk for the purposes of your book, was a Wall Street trader dealing mostly in high-risk, short-term investments. What happened psychologically when he went into remission from the cancer and he was let out of the hospital after a long stay there?
He couldn't get his bearings. It was as though everything that had structured his life now seemed unimportant and gave him no direction. And for a while, he was in this miraculous, really near miraculous remission. I had thought he would live a few weeks, and the cancer melted, and he lived several months. But during that time, he was very remote and very much not himself. At first, I thought maybe he was depressed. A lot of people go through a real shock and then he returned to life. But it turned out that he wasn't depressed. It turned out that he had realized that he had essentially wasted his life and was filled with profound regret.
Did he do anything to try to change his life in the short time he had left to live?
I think the really tragic dimension to this is that he didn't know how. He had never really developed the relationships, or one can say the mechanisms or the know-how, to really act on the realization that came so late in his life. And when the cancer came back, as I write in the story, he presented to me in a very brutal, brutally honest way his insight that his life essentially had been wasted. He had no time, and he really didn't know what to do, and faced the end of his days really a shattered person.
Is it harder to watch somebody die with regret than it is to watch somebody die in pain?
Well, I think regret is probably the most acute form of pain, and it's a form of pain that can't be taken away with narcotics, morphine, the kinds of medications which I believe we can give to people effectively at the end of life to temper the physical pain. It's a spiritual form of pain, and it's one that is, for me at least, having seen it, terribly frightening and unnerving.
What did you think your role was, if any, as the doctor in dealing with this, you know, kind of existential pain that your patient was going through?
Well, I was hard-pressed to come up with a solution. I had no glib answer for him, and he wouldn't let me off the hook. At first, I tried to say to him, well, no, it's really not that way. You have a wife, you have kids, they care about you, and so on. But in the same candor that he lived the rest of his life, he said to me, that's not true, you know that. You know, I'm a shit, is what he said to me. I'm an awful person in this dimension, and I've wasted my life. And I looked into my own background and my own experience and thought about my father, who had died at a young age, and whom I loved dearly, and was a very, very different person than Kirk. And we used to speak a lot about death and about the idea of an afterlife. And my father said that, you know, he didn't really know, of course, if there is an afterlife or not, but what he did know was that there was memory. And memory is the one legacy that we leave to those after we're departed. And so I offered to Kirk some element related to memory. And I suggested, as hard as it might be, that he should tell his wife and tell his children this awful realization with the hope that when they remembered him, that this understanding, this insight would protect them or assist them from repeating the mistake, the awful mistake that he had made.
And his reaction?
I never knew, to be frank. He listened. He was understanding, but he never told me whether he would or not. And as events unfolded, he went back home. He died in a hospice. And I was never in a position to really press or pursue with his wife whether this had occurred.
You've seen patients die in terror and other patients die in peace. Have you come to think that one's attitude toward death can be changed, that you can kind of teach yourself to have you know, what we'd call a good attitude about death?
I think so, and I think a great deal of it comes from my own sense of death and the awful trauma that I experienced when I had just begun medical school. And I write about this in the beginning of the book. I was called in the middle of the night. I was in Manhattan at Columbia PNS, and I rushed out to Queens, where my mother stood at the bedside of my father. He was a young man who had had a massive heart attack and rushed to a community hospital. And my mother and I stood there and actually witnessed my father die. It was not only an untimely death, but probably a necessary death, because it was a hospital without an intensive care unit. There was no cardiologist in attendance, there was no intervention, which really gave him an opportunity to be saved. But having seen the person who really I loved more than any in the world and who had centered and guided my life die somehow took away from me the mystery, or some of the mystery, took away the edge of fantasy. It was very concrete. It was very real. And in some way, I just sensed that if this had happened to him, and I felt so much a part of him, then I knew, yes, it would one day happen to me. And although I still, of course, have fears of death and have no desire to die, I feel I'm very blessed in my life. I hope that when my time comes, I won't be filled with terror, but I'll have witnessed his death and the deaths of others, which in some way will calm my fear and allow me to approach it, understanding that it's part of the continuum of life.
Do you think that watching your father die, what you thought was an unnecessary death, you thought he could have survived with better medical intervention, has that affected your approach as a doctor?
Deeply. I believe in the power of science and the power of technology, and I believe that as a physician caring for people, you're absolutely committed to do the best you can, that every detail has to be examined, and you have to put yourself into it 100% and provide everything that can be provided to them. I also, I didn't write about this in the book because frankly it was too painful and I didn't really have the words to express it. But the doctor who attended my father was a general practitioner who happened to be on call that night in this community hospital. And there was my father. He had just died. And my mother and I were standing in shock, just emotionally shattered. And this physician looked at me and said, "It's really tough, kid," and walked away. I thought many times about those words could not imagine that that was the most compassion that he could articulate, that was really the best that he could say.
My guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman, author of the new book, The Measure of Our Days, New Beginnings at Life's End. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman, professor of immunology at Harvard Medical School. You know, you write in your book that when the frustration of dealing with terminal illness gets to you, it's nice to have laboratory work to do and to deal with disease from a completely different point of view. What does the laboratory work do for you?
Right. I think being engaged in the process of discovery and having a sense that the work you do may help change reality, change the suffering, and change the outcome of diseases which are currently seen as fatal, that's enormously energizing. And it's real. I write about, in the prologue to the book, a classmate of mine, Eric Gold, that is his real name, who in fifth grade developed leukemia. In those days, people didn't use words like that. They didn't say cancer or leukemia. We were lied to. We were told in the class that he had blood poisoning. And Eric withered and ultimately died. 80% of children are cured now with childhood leukemia. And those who aren't have the opportunity for bone marrow transplant, which is still somewhat experimental for them. But there's a reasonable chance Eric would have lived had science advanced to the point to develop drugs and know how to use them. And I believe that will occur with AIDS. I think there's been important advances made with the protease inhibitors. They're not a cure. They don't work for everyone. And there is some slippage now. But they have restored life and functioning to many people. And I believe the same will be true in breast cancer and other diseases that are currently incurable.
What are you working on now in the laboratory?
We're working on a part of HIV called REV, R-E-V. It's a guide that actually moves the virus from the center, from the nucleus of the cell, out into the cytoplasm and then into the bloodstream. And we are making crystals of this REV protein, just like crystals were made of the protease part of HIV. This is an entirely new technology which is revolutionizing drug development. You can take important proteins that are targets for drugs and force them to assume a crystal formation in a test tube and then bounce X-ray beams off them, and you get a sense of the topology of the three-dimensional structure of the protein. And using high-performance computers, you can actually simulate how drugs, how candidate drugs, would dock onto the crevices and surfaces of the protein. And this is how the protease inhibitors were developed. It would have taken decades using older methods of drug development to create these drugs, but using computers that could simulate how the drugs might fit into the protease and prevent that part of HIV from functioning, from working. Five different drugs were developed, each patented actually, therefore very distinct, which are able to poison that part of the virus. We're doing the same thing in breast cancer. We discovered a very exciting gene which appears important in breast cancer called CHK. It opposes the growth of the cancerous cell. It appears that the breast switches it on as it transforms from normal to malignant tissue. And we've begun making crystals of the CHK protein and studying its structure and hope to use that information to help develop new and more targeted therapies for breast cancer.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is my guest, and he works with people who are stricken with cancer and AIDS. His new book, The Measure of Our Days, is about working with patients who have what may be terminal illnesses. Let me ask you, watching so many people dying, and in your years as a doctor, you've seen a lot of people die. Do you ever go around thinking, well, this is the kind of death I want, this isn't the kind of death I want? Do you go around almost like rehearsing for your own death and planning the kind of attitude that you want to have?
Well, I do two things. And one is actually one of the motivations of writing the book, is that I look at the experiences of people at this time, not all of whom die in the book, thankfully, but say, what answers do they give me, or at least what questions do they pose, so that while I'm still healthy and still intact, I can set priorities and develop perspective, which hopefully will be more substantial. And I do think about my own death, particularly now. I'm 45 years old. I'm approaching the age that my father was when he died. And I know certainly the kind of end that I don't want. I don't want to end up like Kirk, looking at the end of my days and feeling that I was filled with regret and had wasted them. And I also don't want to be in pain. And I don't want to enter into a vegetative state or have my life prolonged beyond what seems to be dignified or meaningful. And I think that's really at the core the whole debate of assisted suicide and when people should be let go. So I think all of these issues are very prominent in my mind. But I don't live a morbid life, I can tell you.
Good. Well, it's funny, just most of the things you mentioned you could control. You know, pain, you say you can control.
By and large, yeah.
Yeah, you can do a do not resuscitate, right. Living testament, and not, you know, tell doctors you don't want to be in a vegetative state. You probably don't have to worry about having... feeling regret that you've lived a worthless life. having been a doctor working with so many people and helping to save so many of them. So it seems like in some ways the things you're most worried about are things that you can control.
I think that's true. Having, you know, the little edge of neurosis that we all have, there are important things in life you don't want to fail at. You don't want to fail at relationships. You don't want to fail in family. You don't want to fail in love. I think that's really at the core,
right.
Of concern. Not that I feel I am, per se, but the future unfolds.
Yeah, well, you're getting into the part that is out of control.
Exactly. Would that it were so easy.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Well, Dr. Jerome Groopman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is the author of the new book, The Measure of Our Days. He's a professor of immunology at Harvard Medical School and chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.